Hello and welcome to this episode of Smarter, a podcast by clinicians for clinicians, brought to you by Mater, an Australian leader in healthcare for more than a century. My name's Gillian Whiting.
And I'm Bronwyn Jennings, gynaecology oncology clinical nurse consultant at Mater Hospital Brisbane.
And we're coming to you from Meanjin, the land on which this podcast is being recorded. Today we are joined by Dr. Nim Cabral, gynaecology oncologist at Mater Hospital Brisbane and Mater Private Hospital Brisbane.
Nim specialises in the surgical management of women with confirmed or suspected gynaecological malignancy and complex benign gynaecological pathology. She is also a senior lecturer at the University of Queensland and a member of the Queensland Centre for Gynaecological Cancer Research.
Nim's current research interests are preserving fertility in young women with endometrial cancer, as well as molecular testing of endometrial cancers.
And today, she's joining us to discuss all aspects of endometrial cancer.
Mater.
Caring for the community for more than a century.
Innovators in health, education and research.
Home to world-class clinicians.
State-of-the-art facilities.
High-quality, patient-centred.
Australia's largest and leading
Turning
maternity
scientific
provider.
Discoveries
Educating
into
life-changing healthcare advances.
Integrity. We are Mater.
We are Mater.
We are Mater.
This is Smarter.
Nim, welcome to Smarter.
Thank you, Gillian. I'm excited to be here today.
Can you start by setting the scene for us? Endometrial cancer, what is the current state of play in Australia? How common is it?
It's actually the most common gynecological malignancy that we see. So I think I was looking up the statistics. It's about 3,500 cases a year that are diagnosed. I think at the MARTA we probably end up doing about 200 of those cases. We know that across Australia, the incidence of endometrial cancer is actually increasing rather than decreasing. And the mortality associated with endometrial cancer is also increasing. And it's the only gynecological cancer where that is actually happening. So it's going in the wrong direction. Having said that, we know that many of these cases are diagnosed very early, about 70%, and most of them will be treatable and curable with surgery alone. And so that early detection is really important to make sure that people fall into that favourable category.
Nim, is there a reason why endometrial cancer is so common? Is there a theory behind that?
I think there's a few working theories. We know that any cancer incidence increases with age. So increasing age in the population does increase your risk of endometrial cancer. The other, I think, major risk factor for Australian women is increasing rates of obesity. So we know that women who live with obesity are much more likely to get endometrial cancer. And the statistics are roughly that you have a 6 times increase in risk of getting endometrial cancer over a population level if you have a BMI over 30. So that's a huge increase in risk. And actually, if you look at all the obesity-related malignancies, endometrial cancer is the most highly correlated. And then other risk factors we think about or that we know about are social deprivation. Mm-hmm. So if you are someone who lives in a more deprived community and I don't know what, you know, the background to that is, potentially you have a poorer diet, much more likely to have health comorbidities, you're also at an increased risk of getting endometrial cancer. And actually our Indigenous population in Australia is much more likely to get endometrial cancer than the Caucasian population. So it's something specifically we should be concerned about for Indigenous women.
Nim, what does the research and the evidence tell us about endometrial cancer and its development?
So that's a really interesting question. I don't know that we have a really firm, you know, understood pathway, but the theory is that especially for those that are linked to obesity, that there are metabolic changes that happen in obesity. One of them is that fat tissue can convert testosterone-like hormones, like androgens, into estrogens. And the estrogen that's produced is quite weak. It's not very strong estrogen, but if you have enough fat tissue and there's enough time for it to accumulate, that sort of acts in an unopposed way on the endometrium. So it's a growth factor. It causes the endometrium to grow. And if you're postmenopausal or if you're a premenopausal woman that has dysfunctional ovulation, like if you had polycystic ovarian syndrome, you don't have the safety hormone for the endometrium. The safety hormone is progesterone. It doesn't come in, it doesn't stabilize the endometrial lining, it doesn't cause bleeding when it gets thick. And so you have this unopposed growth of estrogen on the lining. It grows and grows and grows. It gets precancerous, it becomes cancer over time. And so that's the theory as to why obesity is linked to that. Why some women who are obese develop endometrial cancer and others don't, we don't understand. Maybe there's some other linkages and some other pathways there. And then we know there are other pathways as well. So for instance, about 5% of women who have endometrial cancer will have a genetic predisposition to getting it. That's commonly sort of known as Lynch syndrome. And so their genes influence the development of endometrial cancer. It's also linked with bowel cancer in some women. And then, you know, there are those other women who are unlucky and we don't understand why, you know, they don't have any risk factors. They've developed endometrial cancer.
GlobalCan 2020 statistics suggest there were more than 417,000 new cases of endometrial cancer, referred to as corpus uteri, worldwide in 2020, and that the incidence rate is increasing rapidly, with current forecasts predicting 608,000 cases worldwide in 2040. The data also demonstrates that incidence rates are generally higher in high-income countries compared to low- and middle-income countries.
Nim, clinicians listening into this podcast today will be aware of the common signs and symptoms of endometrial cancer. Are there more unusual symptoms that clinicians should be aware of as well?
Look, I think so. I think you can kind of break it down into postmenopausal and premenopausal. So I think in the postmenopause, you know, the classic symptom is any bleeding after menopause vaginally. But we know that sometimes what people think is urinary bleeding or bowel related bleeding is actually vaginal. So it shouldn't be discounted and it should be at least examined for if women are complaining of that, and a pelvic ultrasound or a pelvic examination should be considered. I think the other thing is that sometimes it can present with unusual discharge. So copious amounts of fluidy discharge that, you know, people are reporting. Often that gets mistaken for thrush and treated in that way, but it should be thought about as well. And I think in the premenopause, women who have dysfunctional bleeding, particularly if they're overweight or obese, should be considered for gynecological assessment. Often that's managed very much at a general practice level and, you know, they're just managed with the pill or Mirena and things like that. But if you do have risk factors for endometrial cancer, you probably should be checked out. And the easiest way to do it is an endometrial sample. Some GPs have the capacity to do that and some GPs will need to refer to a gynecologist.
Yeah. What else? Is there anything else that you'd like to see GPs and other clinicians that they should prioritise? And what would you like them to be recommending to patients to reduce risk?
So I think if you are a person who lives with obesity and you have any abnormal bleeding, it should be obviously promptly investigated. I think if you're a woman who lives with obesity, GPs should include questions about endometrial cancer risk, such as bleeding, discharge, etc., to a health screening that is done for you in the same way that they would screen you for diabetes or heart disease, because we know that those are also increased in women who live with obesity.
Women who are diagnosed with endometrial cancer who have an increased BMI often have a number of other comorbidities as well, like diabetes and hypertension. What does this mean for them in terms of treatment pathways?
We know that treatment in women who have higher BMIs can be challenging. Sometimes it's challenging for the reason that they're very overweight and surgery can be unsafe from an anaesthetic point of view, from an intra-abdominal operative point of view, because the access of our instruments is more difficult and the crowding of the abdomen with bowel and other tissues is harder to see what we need to see. And so there is certainly a surgical access and a safety issue, but most of the time this can be overcome and we do successfully operate on, women who have significant obesity safely. If a woman who is obese has other medical issues or with endometrial cancer has other medical issues such as hypertension, sometimes coexists with severe lung disease or other things, it does make operating on them hard from a medical comorbidity perspective. So one of the things we try and do is really approach these patients with a multidisciplinary team to try and optimize all facets of their health, both from an exercise physiology weight optimization perspective, sometimes requiring referral to bariatric services, but also getting them to see medical specialists to optimize what we can of their high blood pressure, their heart function, and investigate those thoroughly, and also including the anaesthetic team. The whole goal is to make sure these patients, if we're going to operate on them, they get through safely and that we don't impair quality of life.
Can you break that down further? Is there a typical treatment pathway for a patient with endometrial cancer?
Yeah, I would say that more than 95% of patients have surgery, and that would be the aim of surgery is to both treat endometrial cancer but also to stage endometrial cancer. So once we've done an operation, which would usually include a hysterectomy, removal of tubes and ovaries, and a lymph gland biopsy, we will have a cancer stage, and then that will determine their risk for recurrence and how we might subcategorize them in terms of requiring further treatment. So many women, about 70%, will not require any further treatment apart from surgery. Some women will require radiation treatment, and some women with higher risk factors will require radiation and chemotherapy. For those women who are not surgically operable, we have a variety of methods that we could manage them, some of which is hormonal. Those with advanced disease might require chemotherapy and other treatments like immunotherapy.
Nim, you just mentioned immunotherapy, which is a new offering for women with endometrial cancer. Can you tell us about the indications for that?
So at the moment, the indications in Australia on the PBS are women who have advanced disease, a diagnosis, so they have more than stage 3 disease, so stage 4 disease, or significant abdominal burden of disease, or they've had successful treatment and they've recurred down the track. The immunotherapy that's available is a combination of pembrolizumab and lenvatinib, and the eligibility for it is determined obviously in our gynaecology MDT, but also by the medical oncologists who prescribe it.
The Australian government expects that 320 women will benefit from the listing of pembrolizumab and lenvatinib on the PBS study each year. It's a game changer for patients, bringing the cost of treatment to no more than $30 a script, saving them up to $170,000 per course of treatment.
Can we delve more into fertility preservation, which is a special research interest of yours? What are the challenges around it, and what can be done?
So in our population at the MARTA, we know that probably about 15% of the people who come are going to be under the age of 45 and potentially wanting fertility preservation. Many of these women have been trying to get pregnant for years, maybe a decade or more, before they're diagnosed with precancer or endometrial cancer. Will have had long periods of infertility and also anovulation, so linked to polycystic ovarian syndrome usually. There are lots of challenges. One is that they're often a cohort that is obese or overweight. And so we know that weight optimization in these patients is really important. It is now happily in Queensland, if you have endometrial cancer or precancer, it's actually a referral criteria for bariatric services. So that's one thing that we do to try and get these women to have successful treatment. Often if they have endometrial cancer, we'll try and treat them hormonally. So we know that, like I talked about before, the safety hormone, the progesterone for the endometrium, can be used in some women to regress the endometrial cancer. We can use it orally or in an IUD form that's called a Mirena. It's not always successful. And in fact, the success rates are quite poor. So if you have endometrial cancer, we know from a large study that was done in Queensland called FEM that your chance of regressing it is about 40% with hormones. If you have pre-cancer, it's a higher chance. It's about 60%. So really early detection in these patients, because we know that often they'll have pre-cancer before they get cancer, is quite important to influence how we can, treat them hormonally. These women obviously want to retain their uterus. We'll try and give them a year or so if within safety boundaries to see whether they can have a successful remission. The statistics on fertility preservation, like if you have successful fertility preservation or treatment of your endometrial cancer, on actually getting pregnant are pretty not fantastic. We know from the literature that only about 15 to 20% actually achieve a pregnancy. which is not great. We try very hard to get them early fertility consultations so they can talk through the options. And some women, you know, their age is a barrier because they've waited a decade and they haven't been successful and they're close to 40. So, you know, we know that naturally your egg quality declines at that point. So if we're going there, I would, you know, we always recommend early fertility consultation and maybe even egg freezing before we can see if your endometrium responds or not.
Nim, I want to touch upon some of the research trials that MARTA is currently taking part in. Endo3 is one of the research studies. Can you tell us what that study's about?
Yes. Endo3 is a surgical trial. So basically, if you think about what our standard of care is currently for endometrial cancer, it's a hysterectomy, it's removal of tubes and ovaries, and it's a sentinel lymph node biopsy. Now, Endo3 is looking to see whether the lymph node biopsy is necessary. So it's a trial that randomizes people into two camps. One, they have lymph node biopsy. One, they don't have lymph node biopsy. At the end of the trial, we're looking to see whether those who had lymph node biopsy who didn't have lymph node biopsy had any worse outcomes compared to people who did. So part of that will be that if you don't have a lymph node biopsy, that we'll try and treat you based on your uterine risk factors for recurrence, which I won't go into in detail. But we're looking to see whether that pathway for treating you is as good as having a positive or a negative lymph node.
Is Endo3 an Australian study or?
Yes. So it is actually a very, very Australian study. It's also a Queensland study. So it's homegrown, been developed by the Queensland Centre for Gynecological Research. And so it's very exciting that it's open here. It's also open in many international sites. Mm-hmm. So I think for us, for endometrial cancer, it will be a big surgical trial that's homegrown that will give some real world results for our patients with endometrial cancer.
Yep. Nim, TAPER study is another mm-hmm. research trial that MARTA is looking to join.
Yes.
Can you let us know what that study's about?
So TAPER is looking at really scrutinising the molecular mutations that people have when they get endometrial cancer and using that information to drive whether they need extra treatment. And I think this is the way of the future. It's the so-called molecular tumor boards where we're looking at everyone's individual mutation, and we know that some mutations are more common in endometrial cancers versus not, to look whether we can de-escalate treatment for them, so not give them any further radiation and they can be treated successfully with surgery alone, even in a more advanced stage, or whether we can whether we have to escalate treatment. So even if they're an earlier stage tumor, they have a higher molecular profile for recurrence, then we would give them extra treatment, extra chemotherapy when they wouldn't necessarily have bought that had we not known that molecular profile.
So much work, Nim, being done in this space, which is exciting. Given that, how do you see endometrial cancer rates and the effectiveness of treatments changing in the next decade or so?
What I hope we can make a difference for is those women who present with advanced disease, because we know, you know, that a lot of women are going to be cured with surgery alone. So early detection is key. Have an operation, you know, you've got a really high chance of cure. That's where surgery is important. And, you know, our operations are getting better, they're getting safer, they're getting faster, and the recovery time for patients is getting better just from us optimizing other factors around surgery. So I think that is a positive path for the future. But I think hopefully that in those women who have had an operation or who have recurrence and they're found to have advanced disease, we can really optimize care there, give those women either cure despite the fact they've recurred or have significant disease at diagnosis, or at least prolong their lives and have good quality of time despite the fact that they have this, you know, advanced endometrial cancer.
So going back to the beginning, I guess, of our conversation, you talked about how rates are increasing.
Yes.
Is that going to turn around?
We hope so. Mm. Time will tell us. I'm hopeful that there's a lot of research being done in this space. And I think the other thing is our increasing use of molecular subtypes of endometrial cancer to drive extra treatments will help with that as well. And that whole concept of having a molecular tumor board where we're looking really at these molecular mutations within cancers and really driving treatment in that way, I think is the whole space for how endometrial cancer is going to be treated in the future. Yep.
Well, all the best and good luck with all of that.
Thanks. Nim.
So, Nim, before we go, we'd like to introduce you to a little segment that we call The Checkup.
Okay.
So it is about finding out about who you are as a person as well as a medical professional. So your mate Bronwyn is going to ask you five probing questions.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You ready to go?
Yeah.
So the first question, and I feel like I should know the answer to this, so I'm sorry that I don't. What's your surgery playlist?
I'm one of these terrible people that don't have music in theatre.
I thought that might have been the case.
If the anaesthetist has like been organised enough to listen, to have a playlist, I'll be fine with that. Yeah. I used to have a boss who played a lot of Justin Bieber. I can tell you that would not be on my surgical playlist.
Yeah. Nim, how would you describe your handwriting?
Very legible. I have made lots of attempts to keep my handwriting legible. I would hopefully be not one of those doctors that would be whose handwriting would be dismissed as doctor's handwriting.
How do you want patients to see you?
I want them to see me as someone who's really good at what I do and able to offer them the breadth of treatments that they need when they come to see me. But I also want them to see me as someone who really cares about them. And so, you know, like I try very hard to make sure that every person I see feels individually, looked at as an individual and also cared for, not just for their surgical cancer treatment, but in a holistic way. Yeah.
If you had to impart one piece of knowledge on a med student, what would it be?
It's often what I say to junior staff who come through as well, is that medicine is a long game. So, you know, you've got to really look at your career in stages. It's obviously a lot of hard work to get to being a junior doctor, you know, going through med school, and there's more hard work ahead of you. And you really have to have the stamina to get through that, because I think there's so much that goes on in people's lives. And, you know, you can be overwhelmed by just even exams that you have to do to get to being a consultant. And you've really got to pace yourself and your career and make sure you don't neglect other aspects of your life.
Mm. No, I think that's great advice. Mm. And the final question, if you had to invite three guests to dinner, who would they be?
Gosh, Albert Einstein, probably Barack Obama. I find him a really interesting person for various reasons, although I didn't always agree with his politics. And then Tom Hiddleston for obvious reasons.
Understood.
Yeah.
Nim, thanks again so much for joining us on Smarter. Now, for our listeners at home or in the car or having a well-deserved break between patients, thank you for tuning in.
Join us for our next episode where we continue exploring women's health.
See you next time on Smarter.